The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 252, Exploring the LDS Church as an Organization, by Laurie D. Padova.
And I'm the chair for this session of the Sunstone Symposium, which is entitled Exploring the LDS Church as an Organization. And I need to remind you that admission to this session is by name tag or ticket only. And if you have not procured either of these, please step outside into the lobby. Sunstone really does need the money. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this session. Our paper will be presented by Laurie D. Padova. And when I was asked to chair a session, I was given my choice of several different topics and presenters. And I chose Laurie because I was here a year ago at the symposium and was at a session that she presided at. And I was very impressed with her expertise and a good sense of humor and dedication to the church. So it's really a nice opportunity for me to get to know her a little bit better and to introduce her. She has a wonderful list of credentials. She is a PhD candidate in organizational behavior at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, the State University of New York at Albany. And that is a mouthful to say. I did practice it quite a bit. And she expects to get that wonderful PhD in November of this year. She has an MS in sociology from the University of Utah and a BA in sociology and philosophy from Mary Washington College of the University of Virginia. She has taught at various institutions of higher learning, most recently the Empire State College and the State University of New York at Albany, the Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, and a place that some of you may have heard of a little bit north, Ricks College. Her area of specialization and interest is organizational hierarchy and managerial leadership and the relationship that these two play. She has been an independent management consultant, a training associate, and a human services trainer. She has published in numerous professional journals, as well as our own Sunstone and Exponent 2 and The Ensign. She's been a presenter at professional conferences, as well as the Sunstone Symposium in Washington, D.C., and several times here in Salt Lake City. She's the mother of two teenage children, one of whom is here today. Glad to have her here to cheer Mom on. And Lori, for 5 years, was a Stake Relief Society president. We have our respondent, David W. Hart, who is also a PhD candidate the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, State University of New York, Albany. And he has an MPA from Brigham Young University, an institution with which some of us have some familiarity, and a Bachelor of Arts degree in archaeology. Well-rounded people here, also from BYU. He has been teaching at the Empire State College, and from his esteemed colleague, I have found that he has published in top-flight professional journals. And if you want more specifics, you need to ask either of these two individuals. And he is married and goes to church, so that's a wonderful recommendation, too. Okay. Our church, the LDS Church. Anyway, the time schedule will be that Lori will have 30 minutes to give her presentation. If she goes 32 minutes, we don't have a little slot here that puts her down in the basement, but we're going to try and hold to 30 minutes, and then David will have approximately 15 minutes to respond. And then hopefully there'll be a few minutes left over, and we can take your questions or comments from the audience. And we would ask that if you have questions to pose or comments, that you would come up to the microphone here at the front so everyone can hear, and then also they can get your lovely voice on the recording machine. So without further ado, we'll introduce Lori.
Thank you, Beverly. That I appreciate those kind words. It's a little embarrassing. I didn't mean for it to go that long. But I'm so happy to be here, and I had forgotten about the sense of humor part that she mentioned, so I forgot to think of a joke. I will tell you, though, that Audra and I are both very happy to be here. We just finished driving across country. This was her first trip driving across country. She got her driver's license in June. I got my driver's side, my passenger side airbag in July. And so we set out, and she's a great driver. We've had a wonderful time. David and I had originally envisioned this session as a more interactive session, so he may interrupt me on some things, and I may interrupt him, and because this is a very complex topic. Actually, I chose a very poor title, Exploring the LDS Church as an Organization, because that's a fitting, churches as organizations are fitting topics for master's and PhD programs. I mean, much less a 30-minute presentation. So I think the most we can do is surface things that have been important to us in helping us look at the church, and not coming to any definitive answers. Please don't think there are any definitive answers here or in organizational theory, for that matter. But that the church is subjected to the same organizational dynamics as we find in other kinds of organizations, public agencies, corporate firms, voluntary organizations, and so forth. And perhaps, and sometimes when we are pained by some things that happen in the church, we can look to the organizational dynamics and find some sort of insights. Let me just start with a quote by Thomas O'Day. I guess I have to... This doesn't sound like it's on, does it? Okay. All right. I'll try to stay from over here then. Maybe I can do this. Okay, here we go. That religion needs most and suffers most from institutionalization. Now, what he meant by institutionalization is slightly different than how we're going to use the term today, but basically what we have here is religious truth, okay? Religious truth that exists regardless of what people believe about it, objective religious truth, okay? Now, how do people learn about it? How do they get taught? How is the truth perpetuated through time? O'Day's point is that without an organization, without institutionalization, religion would not survive through time. But with an organization, religion becomes distorted in some ways. You see, I mean, this is a very profound, I think, a very profound type of thing. And we look at organizations in general, we see that they are very important in our lives. Sometimes we think that we may not have that much to do with organizations, but folks, most of us were born in organizations. Most of us will die in an organization. Most of us receive health care in an organization. If we want to be hermits and go off somewhere and grow our own food and do our own thing, we often will do so with the help of tools that have been manufactured in organizations, the help of knowledge and books that have been produced in organizations and so forth. So there's very little that we do in life that does not have some kind of organizational basis to it. And religion is not exempt from that. Now, at the same time, let me just give one, excuse me just a second, one wonderful example of institutionalization and how it's needed. And I just think this is just very rich. It's in Exodus 12. And if you remember, the Israelites were in very dire straits under the Egyptians and so forth, and the Lord planned to liberate them. And so what did he do? He instituted the Passover. And in fact, in the scriptures, it says, it starts out chapter 12 in the little summary at the top. It says, the Lord institutes the Passover. Here we have institutionalization. Very specific on what the Israelites were supposed to do, what kind of lamb to get, and what kind of posture to be in when eating the lamb. And if you look at the detail, think, why is it all that detail? And you look in the chapter, and I won't go into it now, but several times it says, you shall keep this, it a feast by an ordinance forever. Keep doing this. And finally, the question is asked, why? Why do this? Why keep doing this every year? We're going to be liberated. The deed's going to be done. Why do it through generations? And the answer is, basically, so that when thy children ask thee, why are we doing these things, you can tell them of the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt. So that generations later, people can feel some of that experience. The Lord, obviously, we cannot recreate that experience every year. That very powerful experience. The only way it's recreated emotionally is through institutionalization. So religion needs most from this. So I rest my case on that. Religion needs most. Now, at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that organizations are contradictory systems. We expect and demand, in fact, contradictory things from organizations. We ask people, what do organizations do? What's the definition of organization? So forth, and you get contradictory answers. And in fact, organizations, if I might just, I'm drawing now from the competing values framework, which encapsulates this very nicely. If you take the circle here as an organization, you see where there are opposing things that are tearing at the organization. Organizations have to be concerned with what goes on inside of it. And the opposite of that is to be concerned with what goes on outside. All right, I think that's pretty logical. But let's go to this other axis, flexibility and control. Organizations, some theorists say, and I know you'll relate to this, is that organizations exist to control people. Why else would organizations exist if it wasn't to control people? So why should we get upset when we feel controlled? We're in organizations. If Henry Ford wants to make cars and he organizes plans to make cars, the only way he has to control the people to have them do certain things at certain times to make the cars. That's a way of control. Let me say that this control provides things that are very important to us. Things like stability. Things like predictability in life. We live, and I think we're all aware of this, in a very uncertain world, in a very uncertain environment. We don't know when what is going to happen next. Sometimes we're painfully reminded of this through death, through divorce, through tragedies that happen. We live in a world of uncertainty. Organizations, in general, religious organizations in particular, provide us with some stability, some things that last over time. And some predictability. Let me say that it is very important that we live in a predictable environment. Let me suggest to you that we all risk our lives on this need to live in a predictable environment. Every day I drive from where I live in Greenwich, New York to Albany, about 50 miles. Most of that is on a two-lane highway. I'll drive 55 mile an hour speed limit. Two-lane highway, and cars coming toward me are driving 55 mile an hour speed limit. I need to predict the behavior of the drivers coming toward me. Now, I don't think if a driver's coming toward me at 55 miles an hour and I'm going toward that driver at 55 and we happen to meet in the middle somewhere, I don't know how many airbags it would take to save us. Okay? Now, when you think of it, here I am driving down the road, 55, here comes a driver toward me. I don't recognize the driver. I don't know the car. I don't know this person that's driving. I don't know the condition of the automobile. I don't know the condition of the tires. I don't know if there are kids in the back seat that are distracting. I don't know if there is a bee in the car. I remember very graphically living in Virginia, at home in Virginia, when a family was killed on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel because of a bee in the car. Okay, tragic, tragic accident. I don't know if this person is eating breakfast and changing a CD and talking on the phone and putting on eye makeup at the same time or what. There's a lot I don't know. Or what kind of medication this person's on, or how much sleep they've had. I don't know all that stuff. But what do? I pull over and wait for that person to pass? No. I keep on. I don't even slow down. I might even speed up. Okay, I need to live in a predictable environment. I need to trust strangers with my life. Okay, so this is, I don't want to underestimate that need. The need to live in a stable, predictable environment is possible only with a measure of control. Okay, and organizations provide that. At the same time, we want organizations to be flexible. We want them to change. We want them to consider individual merit. One of the delightful and painful dilemmas of bureaucracy sometimes is that bureaucracy treats everyone the same. And we may balk at that, but believe me, when a Kennedy kid graduates from law school and tries three times to pass the New York State bar exam, we don't want an exception made to that kid because he's a Kennedy. That's one of the beauties of bureaucracy. Everyone's treated the same. But at the same time, when we have special circumstances and come before DMV, we want an exception made in our case. You see, so this is one of the human elements here. So we do want organizations to be flexible. What happens from this is that there are differing definitions of organizational effectiveness. What happens from this is these mutually exclusive tensions and competing values fall on the shoulders of managers and leaders in organizations. Okay, and that they have to respond in that kind of environment. I feel like I need to move on rather quickly here. Let me just make the next very important point, and that is there is an inevitable tension between an organization, as we've just described, any organization, and the needs of the individual. This is a classic tension in organizational theory. It's a classic tension in life. The organization will have certain needs, will need to survive, will need to meet goals and so forth, and at the same time there are individual needs. We want individuals to be able, so say for instance someone needs a job done, you have to have the report in, but the person doing the job needs to go on vacation or needs to go to their son's baseball game. There would be this tension between the needs of the organization and the needs of the individual. Organizations need to control. Individuals need autonomy. They need to feel affirmed as individuals. They need to feel valuable. They need to feel not subjected to the control. Okay. Now, I hope that you're with me on this and that it isn't too dry and boring, but the fascinating thing with ecclesiastical institutions, and I think with our church, is that we not only have that tension between the individual and the organization, we actually magnify it. We say each individual is precious. We say each individual is of ultimate divine worth. We teach the gospel of Jesus Christ, which says the Savior died for each person. There is no more powerful message anywhere that I know of the ultimate value of each individual person than that Jesus died for each one as an individual. So we not only have the tension between the organization and the individual, we're saying that the individual is the most important thing of all. So this magnifies it for us. So sometimes when we see individuals not respected, individuals demeaned, not treated right and all that, we quite rightfully feel offended. We feel the church might be wrong here. The church needs to focus on individuals. What I'm trying to say is at the same time the church has these constraints. The church needs to survive through time. The church has large numbers of people to teach. and to control. And I'm using that in a benign sense. And we want the control. I talked to a young woman yesterday who spent last summer in Saratoga. I said, did you find the church any different in Saratoga than you do in Salt Lake? She's lived in Salt Lake all her life. She said, no, it's basically the same. There's comfort in that. And it's comfort precisely because of the control. How would you like it as Latter-day Saints to go anywhere in the world and you don't know what you're going to walk into when you walk to an LDS chapel? You have no idea what's going to happen. It would not be comfortable. So we want the predictability and stability that comes with this. Okay, let me just surface a few more things here. Maybe this is one of the most, I guess, painful things for me. Irving Goffman, a psychologist who wrote, I think, one of the most important things in organizational behavior, wrote the book Asylums. As a result of his experience as a self-admitted inmate into a mental institution in the 1950s. Mental institutions have changed since that time, but his insights are very astute. What is fascinating about, a number of things are fascinating about Goffman, and I would recommend that book to you, but one of the things that is fascinating is this. You can have an organization. You have the same climate, the same physical location, okay, the same place, and you have people within that organization. You have inmates and staff. Okay, the point that's relevant here is that here are human beings speaking the same language, same cultural background, in the same organization, at the same spot, at the same point in time, living in entirely different worlds. Living in entirely different and distinct social worlds. This is a hierarchy. Actually, I've put it upside down. That is a hierarchy. This is what hierarchy does. It divides people and puts us into different social worlds. He points out, and let me just say, when I'm talking about hierarchy, I think men have their experience with hierarchy and women have their experience with hierarchy. As far as men are concerned, there's a hierarchy of authority. Let me say that hierarchy of authority also carries with it a status hierarchy. A status hierarchy means that people have different perceived social worth on the basis of their position in the hierarchy. The higher up one goes, the more valuable one is perceived to be. The more important one is perceived to be, the more credible, the presumption of credibility increases as one ascends the hierarchy. This leads to one of Thomas O'Day's points that organizations have statuses and roles. And so people can participate in organizations basically in order to go up on the hierarchy or for social status rather than for religious purposes. This is what an organization makes possible. In the case of women, of course, are not in the hierarchy of authority, as we all know. However, they are part of this kind of hierarchy. They are the lowest level participants in the organization of the church because they are excluded from the hierarchy of authority. Let me just mention the men. All right, with the layers of hierarchy for men, it becomes something to strive for. And the point I'm trying to make here, if I don't keep forgetting it, is that positions in the church are not things that people apply for. You don't apply to become a bishop or stake president. You have to wait to be called to that position. And the presumption is that the calling is based upon whether the leaders over you approve of what you're doing. So this can lead. It doesn't always lead. I'm not suggesting this at all. But it is a situation that is set up that can encourage approval-seeking behavior. When approval-seeking behavior is encouraged, this means that if we want to be approved of by the hierarchy and ascend the hierarchy, we don't want to disagree with them because then they might not call us to positions. So this is it discourages a diversity of thought. And I think that is important, not because of not only because of free speech issues, but it's important for organizations. There's a wealth of evidence that shows that whenever people think alike, organizations tend not to get all the information they need to make the sound decisions that they need to make. Let me speak to the women in the hierarchy just briefly. Between men and women as a hierarchy, women at the lowest end, they're not in the authority, so they're the lowest level participants in the organization. For women, often their legitimacy is tied to their husband. So a woman whose husband's his sole calling is the home teacher may not feel, this is how she experiences it, that she's as legitimate as a woman whose husband is the stake president. In fact, if we hear that these two women disagree on something, we may tend to assume that the woman whose husband is stake president or whose husband is the general authority is more credible than the woman whose husband, or who doesn't have a husband, basically. We have that too. So married women may engage in approval-seeking behavior for their husband's advancement because that's the only way that they can advance. You notice, too, part of the women's experience is that they are interviewed by men for callings and for temple recommend interviews, sometimes on very personal matters, but men never have the opportunity to be interviewed by women. You see, they never have that opportunity. Goffman points out that these are two separate and distinct social worlds. He points out that social mobility between the two does not exist, that there are different communication patterns. And let me say, I have seen this. I have been in meetings with Stake Relief Society presidents who are wonderful, strong, incredible women, and just asserting their viewpoint and so forth. And then we adjourn and go to a meeting of stake presidents and regional representatives and so forth, and all of a sudden the communication pattern changes. All of a sudden everything they say is tentative and is cast in ways to be sure not offend the brethren, that we don't want them to think that we know more than they do by any means. But we are petitioning them for to consider our ideas. Information boundaries are clear. It's very clear that there's information that men have access to in the church that women do not. Let me mention something on communication boundaries, and that reinforces this difference in hierarchy, and that is the phrase brethren and sisters. This has become something that I've given a lot of thought to lately. Why do we often hear brethren and sisters and not brothers and sisters? We hear both, but sometimes we hear brethren and sisters a lot, particularly in the temple. We have lesson manuals titled Follow the Brethren. The brethren is a term of authority. It's for men in authority, that we apply that term to the general authorities. The problem is we also apply that term to every man in the church, which puts women in a very difficult position, so that when their husband is one of the brethren, because he's a man and he's referred to that as that in the temple, and she has a differing view, you see, she's much more inclined to believe that he's more credible and legitimate than she is in his ideas, than he is inclined to consider her perspective. Do you follow what I'm saying here? Did I say that right? In other words, if we take the term brethren and has it as a term of authority, we apply that to every man in the church, then every marriage will have that dynamic to deal with. And I submit that, you know, many women find it much more difficult to come to terms with their own credibility and legitimacy in the church than men do. I think this resonates with what Goffman was saying about these distinctions, and it's interesting to know that we can be in the same church, in the same ward, same stake, every Sunday, and live in two entirely different worlds. I'd like to say in closing that this is just touching the surface of some of the organizational dynamics. We need the church as an organization. The church needs these dynamics. And I don't believe for a minute that that the brethren or the general authorities mean to do people harm or women harm at all. But I think that most of the time, you know, they simply don't understand the different worlds that we live in. I had a very respected sociologist at the New School for Social Research say to me that the problem with leadership scholars is that they did not understand what bureaucracy is and what it does. And I think maybe sometimes the problem with managers in organizations, and not to mention church leaders, is that it's hard to understand what these dynamics are and to respond to them. By the way, just let me just mention this. I don't know if you've seen this. Speaking of hierarchy, and I'll say this to rest my case with the men and women, this Farms lecture tour brochure, I don't know how many of you got this, but there's a lecture tour of Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and Galilee with the fees on here. Please note that if you are a Melchizedek priesthood leader, you get a $400 discount. If you are an auxiliary president and seminary teacher, you don't get $400 discount, but $300. You see, perceived social worth, folks. It even adds up to dollars and cents. Okay, thank you very much.
I now have the unenviable task of responding to all of this. Lori and I are, as you may have heard, are in the same program back in Albany. And we spend a lot of our free time discussing and arguing about these things. And I personally have spent the last several years, anyway, studying bureaucracy and all its weaknesses. And, for example, one of the steps in the PhD process is you take a comprehensive exam, and it's kind of the capstone of all the studying you do. And one of the kind of the capstone comprehensive question we had was discuss all the weaknesses of bureaucracy. All of organization theory in the last 50 years has centered around criticizing bureaucratic forms. And it's very easy to do that. And I think as members of the church, it's very easy to criticize the bureaucratic form, bureaucratic structure of the church. And Lori and I both recognize that, and we have both attempted to take the harder road of looking at it in a somewhat positive light, and I'm going to try to take even more of a positive light of looking at how, despite how bureaucratized our church has become, how well it is doing, because it is remarkable. Because if you think about it, the church is one of the oldest and most developed modern bureaucracies that still exists, and is very successful, in fact. If you look at it as just a modern bureaucratic organization. For example, for those of you that are familiar with bureaucracy, it's attributed to a man named Max Weber, and he listed out six fundamental foundations that are necessary for a bureaucracy to exist and be successful. One of those was thorough and expert training. Now, and that is very important, he notes, for success in a bureaucratic organization. We as church members don't receive a lot of thorough and expert training. An excellent case in point is I served a mission in Mexico, and I was transferred to a ward where a young man was bishop, and he had converted when he was 18 years old. At 20, he went on a mission, came home at 22, got married in the temple, and at 23 was a bishop. And that's a fairly common occurrence down there where the church is still growing. And this young man had been involved in the church for 5 years, had been married less than a year, and was the bishop of the ward. He was the steward of this ward and did an excellent job. Needless to say, he had no training, no expert and thorough training. We can apply this to a lot of situations. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, about 2 weeks before I came out here, I was called to be the young men's president. Now, I don't have a natural talent with the youth, to the contrary. yet, I have been called to that position, and it is expected that I will do a good job, and I will try to do my best. I asked around to see if there was some type of manual I could maybe browse through to get some general ideas of what I should be doing in this position. Didn't receive one. This is a pretty common case, I think, in the church. We don't receive thorough and expert training. Yet, the church, as an organization, has done remarkably well without these people, without thorough and expertly trained individuals. Another point, and I'm just going to kind of move circuitously around all of this. Another purpose of bureaucracy, according to Max Weber, was to dehumanize the actions of individuals within the organizations, to remove the accountability of individuals. And therefore, you can have more predictability in decision-making and in the processes of organization. This transformation is from what's called social action to bureaucratic action. And I won't go into detail here, but for those of you that are familiar with this, I have an excellent quote from a book by a man named Ralph Hummel. He writes a book called The Bureaucratic Experience, which is a kind of a textbook, but it's an excellent, excellent book. And quickly, he says, "The social separation of the actor from his or her actions, as well as from other human beings, creates a new orientation," talking about the bureaucratic process. "Human beings become accustomed to engage in functions and actions neither on behalf of themselves nor of someone else. Rather, they act on behalf of an abstract system, the purposes and logic of which they do not fully understand because of the nature of the functions themselves." What he's saying is here is that in bureaucracies, individuals and the processes tend to become detached, so that decisions are made without thought and they're separated. The individual and the function are separated. Well, again, without going into too much detail, I would argue that doesn't necessarily exist in the organization, at least down in the ward and stake levels, which I am most familiar. The nature of our organization as a church prevents that, and we have done remarkably well to prevent the dehumanizing of our processes, of our decision-making and actions in our church. I've got to skip over a couple things here. Lori mentioned the contradiction. She put up the competing values framework that showed those contradictions in organizations. And there is a contradiction between control and flexibility in organizations. And this is another area where I think we've done, as a church, we've done an excellent job of dealing with this contradiction. And I started thinking about this, and I just jotted this down while Lori was talking. And in organization theory, as a generic study of organization, the trend is to move away from bureaucratic systems toward more flexible systems, etc. And I started thinking, and typically what happens in an organization, a heavily bureaucratized organization, is they'll hire a consultant like Lori to come in, they'll pay her a lot of money to come in and change the organization and make it a much more flexible, human-oriented organization. I was thinking about it, and what is our alternative? Our organization is based on revelation. We can't hire slick consultants to come in from big universities and show us how to make a more flexible organization, although Lori and I would like to have a shot at it. But that's not really an alternative. And another thing, if you look at the corporate world, they bring consultants in, and they're always experimenting. One week it's TQM, Total Quality Management. Another week it's Participative Management and all of this kind of stuff. I don't know if we could do that as a church. We can't really experiment with our bureaucratic form. We received it from revelation, and if things need to change, we'll receive more revelation on how things should change. But we've dealt with this tension between flexibility and control very well. And I've actually wanted to put another element of this framework that Lori put up and put predictability versus revelation. That's another tension that exists in the church. And I think we would all admit, and again, it would be very easy to criticize the bureaucracy and the bureaucratized elements of our organization. I admit, and I think we would all grant, that the church has become bureaucratized. But again, my whole point is that we've dealt with it remarkably well. One of the predictions of a bureaucratized process is the isolation and removal of accountability from those at the top, from top management, if you will. And that process, to a certain extent, has happened in our church. But if you look at it, actually, a couple of examples. Decision-making is isolated at the top. Financial accountability is all centered at the top. Those are two examples. Yet, if we look at it and we compare our organization to other organizations, there have been very few, if any, abuses at the top. Let me give an example. The board of directors of our organization, if you want to call them that, do not receive any money from the church. They're not paid by the church. They're over a period of time, if they wanted to, could somehow work out a plan where those at the top do receive maybe a stipend or something like that. That hasn't happened. There are no financial abuses going on in the church. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the Arizona Republic. A couple years ago, decided they were going to expose the church financial systems, which is very complicated and were very difficult to get a hold of. Yet they were, the wind was kind of taken out of their sails when they finally got a hold of everything and realized that the church, although very conservative, has done very well financially. And I don't mean making money. I mean in terms of not abusing it, not spending it in wrong ways or things like that. The church has done remarkably well in that area. Finally, I would suggest that the corporate world could maybe learn something from our bureaucratic process. And this is something Lori and I talked about right before we came out here. Academics and consultants and now a lot of people in organizations are all talking about participative management, empowering individuals, etc. And I think they could learn a lesson, and we can learn a lesson from our church. And the point where this really we became very aware of this was what I call the fluidity and mobility of members in the church. And this really hit home for me when I was I'm visiting my parents here. I was talking with my father, and he's in a ward down in Provo, up on the bench, and he's in the high priest's group leader, and he gives the lessons he teaches in the he's the high priest group leader or teacher or something. Anyway, he said that he looks out in the crowd and nearly every single person in the high priest group has been a bishop, a stake president, a mission president, in these positions of power and the potential for incredible power over individuals. Yet all these people are content for the most part with just being in the high priest group leader, in the high priest quorum, being home teachers, etc. And for as many people that have held as high positions in our church as they have and have gone back down to whatever, we have done remarkably well as a church. And I thought, Lori and I were talking about this, and we thought, why don't organizations in the private sector, out in the corporate world, do this? You've been vice president over finance for 5 years now. You're kind of burned out. We're going to send you back down to be a line manager. For those of you that work in large organizations, know that this would not go over well at all. The idea is in organizations that you work your way up. That kind of exists in our church, but for the most part, again, if you think about how many people do go up and down, the church has done remarkably well. And the church is stronger because of that, because people have had different positions. And if you stay in a position for too long, you can burn out. And so the church has started looking and saying, you know, we don't want to leave people in too long because you do start to burn out. You can release them and let them just kind of float for a while and get remotivated. And it would be an interesting idea to bring this out to the corporate sector and try that out in business. I don't know if you want to respond to anything or make any closing comments. I know we need to open it up for questions. Let me see if you have any questions. Does anybody have any questions? Or comments? or comments, or do you need them to come up to the...
The thought occurred to me that, it would be understandable that it would be easier for a stake president to become a deacon's quorum advisor because he's not paid for either one. So although there's a loss in status, there's not a loss in income. Whereas a vice president of a corporation would take a real hit if he became a line leader or something.
That's a very good point. But you could say that if the trend continues and we follow kind of the more, for lack of a better word, Japanese style of management, people are paid by seniority and by the time they have in the organization. And that could be worked out that the person doesn't necessarily have to take a pay cut because they have served the organization well, hopefully, in those positions, those higher positions.
You made a couple statements that I disagree with or would like to have you explain. One is the idea that the bureaucracy is divine. I don't know of any scripture where the form or the order that we now operate under, the church operates under, was given by revelation. Second, that the leaders of the church receive no money for serving as leaders of the church when they're put on the boards of the corporations the church owns and get paid for that.
I feel inadequate to respond to the top board of directors or whatever because I'm really not familiar with that. I live 2,000 miles away from what goes on around here and feel actually fairly distant from it. I am speaking more from a ward and stake level, but your point is legitimate, and I am not aware of the positions there, so I don't feel like I should respond to that because I'm not informed. Do you?
Yeah, well, I can just add, I think those are excellent points, and in fact, O'Day mentions that as the institution becomes more legitimate, it becomes more closely tied with the values of the society, and one of the rewards of upper-level leadership is that they become involved in other institutions of society, just like you're saying, boards of directors, and get compensation for that. And that this is one of the mixed motivation, that in other words, there's possible with an organization to reach a point where the primary motivation, and we cannot search everyone's hearts to see what it is, but it's possible where the prime motivation is not religious, but in fact it's more social, it's more rewards, financial, possibilities, power, influence, prestige, and so forth. And that, and I should say that this is not only true of our church and our religious organization, but anyone, any ecclesiastical institution where the institution has attained a legitimacy in society. I think we see that in the Roman Catholic Church, in the Baptist churches in the South, and so forth. So those are excellent points.
I find it difficult to subscribe to you addressing organizations, with a profit line and a business concept to organize religion. This is an example. If I'm in a profit-making organization, you're my boss, and you fire me, I can get really irritated about that, because of our personality differences or whatever caused the firing. But in a religious organization such as the Mormon Church, if I'm fired, quote, released, and my stake president says, hey, it's not me, God did it, he revealed that to me to do it, I have a difficult time to get too upset with God, where I could have really got upset with you. So I don't really see the comparison that you're making an awful lot between normal business organizations and church organizations.
Right. I've tried to keep it at a generic organization level and not just a profit-making organization. But actually bring up an excellent point that, but I will turn that, again, not to be Mr. Positive, but look at it from a positive light. Look at the potential for abuse there that exists in that situation. Although we all probably have stories of abuses, if we look at the church as a whole, as a member, as I don't know how many millions of members we have now, 8 million, something like that, that doesn't exist that much.
Well, I can I just say something to that? I think that that's an excellent point about accountability. And that is, if we are released, when we don't want to be released, we haven't asked to be released, you can be very awkward to ask, you know, why have I been released, and maybe not get an honest answer, not get what in other organizations we would have as feedback, you see, and not get an honest answer. And that is a very painful dimension of hierarchy. Let me just say, I certainly don't mean to imply, I don't think David does, that the church is a business, but that there are generic organizational dynamics that will characterize all organizations. I think what you pointed out is an excellent one, where in an ecclesiastical institution, it takes a particularly painful spin. You know, and if it would be very helpful to people if they could get feedback. But can you imagine someone? I know of people who have been men called as high priest for many years and never been called as bishop, and there's some kind of norm where they take their turn or something, depending upon what region of the country they're in. And they reach a point where they wonder why they've never been called as bishop. And everyone else in the high priest group has, and they haven't. There's no way for them to go to their leaders and find out. You see, they haven't gotten no way to get any feedback. These are faithful men. So, you know, this kind of secrecy that we find in ecclesiastical institutions, you're very right. It's very painful consequences for people. Yes, ma'am.
My comment more in the form of a question than a comment, but a statement made something about the church can't hire consultants. As my remembrance, way back in the cobwebs of my mind, that the church indeed did contact BYU for consulting help from the organizational behavior department, which led to the correlation. Perhaps someone in the room here knows about that and could enlighten us.
Actually, I'm familiar with that, and yes, they did. And I was the church still does actually consult with people that are experts in the field. And I should have qualified my remarks more by saying, being more specific about the kind of the general hierarchy of the church, and not the kind of the administrative workings of the church, because those do change, and as we become more international, we need to expand, and you know, there are the administrative details that need to be worked out, and the church refers to consultants a lot on those. I was referring more to general. You just come up to the microphone, I assume would be easiest.
You mentioned going up and down. I'm wondering if either one of you had comment on the concept that maybe it isn't up or down in the church, that maybe a primary teacher is just as important or maybe more important than a stake president.
In fact, I caught myself when I was saying that. I caught myself in the trap that I'm trying to speak against, that I was saying up and down, and it's not up and down, because it's and it isn't if we look at the intent of the church and the way it should work. We oftentimes fall into that trap because we make comparisons to other organizations that one is moving up. You know, one could argue that, you know, the most effective individuals in organizations are primary and youth leaders, because they are the ones that are socializing these people and helping these people get a foundation in the church. So,
well,
you are correct.
I think you two are making an excellent point in terms of the truth of the gospel, in terms of how people are viewed. But in my view, every organizational message, in terms of the structure of the organization, is that perceived social worth increases as you go up. And that, I think that many of us know that primary teachers are just as important, more important than the stake president, but they don't get the message, the organizational message that they are. They are excluded from information. They're not given the deference. They're not given the credibility. They're not given the institutional rewards that those higher up given. So this is part of the disjuncture between the supreme value of the individual and the messages of hierarchy which says it's more importance, more credibility, more legitimacy as one ascends.
Yeah, let me just quickly respond to that.
What is up? Now you say that it's up. What if it isn't up?
Yeah, let me give an example.
Just from an organizational perspective, it's up. You know, the narrower it goes, there are fewer stake presidents than there are primary teachers, for instance.
It's by numbers.
By numbers.
Usually yeah. That's what it is in yes. or in perks, various
but,
perks.
But is it a given that it's always up?
You mean...
If you put it on a chart, then it's up.
But what I'm trying to get outside of that thought
yes,
and
yes,
say,
yes.
Is it possible to get outside that thought and think and have people think things are not up or down? It's just you hold a position and then you hold another position.
It's very difficult. I think it's possible. It's very difficult to do in an organizational hierarchy.
In our society
this
today.
This one lady needs
to comment. Yeah. I just wanted to say that one of the most hopeful talks I ever heard at a Sunstone Symposium was by J. Bonner Ritchie, and I have it on tape and play it over and over sometimes, in which he said the church had finally realized the need for non-member consultants to help them learn how to become an international church. And he quoted President Tanner in a meeting where he said, yes, we could go to BYU for advice, but we know that they will only tell us what they think we want to hear. And so it was so important for them to hire, as I understood it, was two different companies from New York or somewhere else to help them understand how to become international. Now, everything I've seen in the last 2 years makes me think that they have fired all those people. And so I would like someone who knows more about it to comment on that. Do they still hire non-Mormon professionals to help us?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I'm on one of the lower level participants in the hierarchy, so I have no way to know.
I'd really like to thank Lori and David. I think they did an excellent job in dealing with a sensitive, sometimes very emotionally charged issue, and we appreciate your comments and most of all your attendance, and want to remind you that tapes of this session are for sale outside, and it's been a pleasure to be with you, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your sessions. Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in again to another session of the Sunstone Symposium. This hour we've been listening to a paper given by Laurie DePadova, in which she considers the idea of exploring the LDS Church as an organization and comparing and contrasting it with other organizations, not only profit-making organizations, but any other kind of large organization, and the problems that larger organizations face when expanding and growing and changing. She was responded to by David Hart, who is a PhD candidate at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at State University of New York at Albany. Just a reminder that, as you may have heard a minute ago, sessions are all taped and are available on tape, and you can call the Salt Lake Hilton. We can be reached at 532-3344, and you can just ask for the Sunstone desk. Join us again in about 15 minutes, or maybe now about 10 minutes. And an apology for those of you who may be expecting to tune in and listen to a paper by Becky Johns discussing the Manti experience and comparing it to what happened in Waco, Texas last year with David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. For purely logistical reasons, we've had to switch that session with a paper that will be given jointly by Daryl White and O. Kendall White, who are sociologists and brothers. Their paper will be entitled Charisma, Structure, and Contested Authority Within Mormonism, and that will be coming your way within about 12 minutes or so. So tune back in just a few minutes, and we will be delivering that to you. Until then, we will join again with the KCPW studios.